And the other one was, I heard it, but the difference in pumping rates, and there was some question about that. The head of the Exxon group said this morning that, you know, at some point they would like to bring the ship systems online. If that were the case, then of course the pumping time would drop precipitously. So we'll be looking forward to talking with you this afternoon. Tom McGinnis.
I've heard lots of reports about tainted seals and otters. Is there going to be a center where we may go to see animals coming in, or are any coming in, or do you anticipate?
There is. You should probably talk to Exxon about that, but they have brought in bird people, and they have a fellow, I believe his name is Randall Davis. You'll have to check with them, but he's from Hubs Marine in San Diego. Oh, okay. Great.
My name is Pamela Bergman. I'm with the Department of Interior out of Anchorage. And myself and Everett Robinson Wilson from Fish and Wildlife Service came over to look specifically at the wildlife protection issue. It's our understanding that the representatives who are here in Valdez from the International Bird Rescue Research Center in Berkeley have been directed by Exxon to go ahead and complete setting up a bird cleaning and rehabilitation facility in this area. I would expect that they would make an announcement later in the day that would contain more of the details of that facility and how it's going to operate. I would say that the most difficult part about this is going to be capturing the birds. As you all know, it's a different situation than the Washington State spill where there's road access to the coastline. It's just very difficult to get out there and try to get any oiled birds. Randall Davis from the Hubs Marine Research Institute in San Diego and two veterinarians are also on their way up to Alaska to, at the request of Exxon, to address, potentially address capturing and rehabilitation of sea otters. It's my understanding that that decision has not yet been made, that they will attempt to do that, but they've asked Dr. Davis, to come up and be prepared to do that. And it's my understanding that he will arrive early tomorrow morning. He's with the Hubs Marine Research Institute. They're associated with SeaWorld in San Diego, and they've done a lot of research on sea otters.
Are they harder to catch than the birds?
Sea otters are much more difficult to catch than birds, and the guidelines that are out indicate that only people with experience catching sea otters should be catching them. That's a little different than with birds, where it's easier to train some volunteers to go out, give them a fairly quick briefing on safety considerations, and send them out. It's my understanding that's really not the case with sea otters. You really need to know how to handle those guys so that no one is getting injured. And it's certainly going to be the federal and state agencies' perspectives that human life and safety is more important than any attempts to try to capture any of these birds or marine mammals. We don't want anyone putting themselves at risk trying to capture any of these wildlife resources.
Will ban on navigation to the area be waived for people who are out capturing birds?
That I'm sure that will be worked out. Yeah, that won't be a problem.
Do you know how many birds have been affected by the oil so far?
What I can tell you is that our Fish and Wildlife Service representative, Everett Robinson Wilson, was out in a boat yesterday and traveled through a fair amount of the area, and it was his estimate that he saw about 75 birds oiled, primarily along the west side of Bly Island. Those were seabirds, mostly white-winged scoters, old squaw, and goldeneye. In addition, he saw two oiled otters. None of the birds or the otters yesterday that he saw could have been captured. They're still in the water. Generally speaking, I know at least for birds, you don't capture birds in the water. It's too dangerous. The birds will dive anyway and get away from you. You probably can't capture them, and people tend to get carried away when they're in the boats and put themselves at risk and capsize. And no one advocates doing that. To catch an oiled bird, you need to wait until it gets out on shore and then try to capture them on shore. There have been people who have indicated a desire to be volunteers, Exxon has established the following number, 835-4391. For people who would like to volunteer in this effort, if they call that number and leave their name and telephone number with those folks, they will get that to the proper individuals, to Randall Davis and to the International Bird Rescue Research Center folks. It's my understanding that people are not actively seeking volunteers at this point. They need to kind of work out the logistics of how all this is going to be done. And as I said earlier, the logistics of getting out there are pretty difficult.
If the wind comes up tonight, do you know what effect that might have on birds or other wildlife? Will it tend to push more of the oil ashore and contaminate more?
Yeah. We know that there are a fairly large number of resources out there. Another Fish and Wildlife Service group did an aerial survey, and we haven't had time to get all the detailed information from them. They flew along the coastline, and their just rough estimates are something like 3,000 seabirds along the coastline, along the Bly Island and that area, and over to Naked Island, and several hundred sea otters.
Would there be any efforts to chase the wildlife from the heavily polluted areas?
That's something that is certainly looked at and advocated, is deterring wildlife away from the area. The numbers of birds that we're seeing and the numbers of sea otters, with the large numbers and the logistical difficulties and the kinds of species that we're looking at, it doesn't look like that's very feasible at this point. But there might be some recommendations of maybe booming some areas to try to divert some oil.
What about these so-called resident pods of killer whales? Is anyone looking at them? Any Exxon bringing anybody up?
National Marine Fisheries Service is the trustee for those particular resources, and I really can't speak to that at this point, sorry. I'm sure that the folks this afternoon can give you more information on that.
This may be something to them also, but I'd heard that there was a sea lion rookery on Glacier Island.
I'm not familiar with that. I did hear some reports yesterday that there were sea lions on Naked Island.
Can you give us your name again?
Pamela Bergman, with two N's, B-E-R-G-M-A-N-N, with U.S. Department of the Interior. B-E-R-G-M-A-N-N.
What species is considered the most critical or the most at risk at this point?
I defer to Everett.
Well, all the seabirds are probably going to be at risk, and the marine mammals, the otters, the sea otters, because they are under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, would be probably the most important. You know, as far as at risk to the oil, the seabirds are certainly going to be the ones that are going to take the hardest hit, probably.
And then,
that we haven't seen large numbers of animals oiled so far, or is it just sort of disaster waiting to happen?
It certainly should be encouraged, and the reason that you probably haven't seen large numbers of birds being affected is because the oil is staying fairly well out in the middle of the sound at this point.
Is it possible that it's just because it covers such a wide area that you're just not seeing lots of places where there might be birds damaged, or you think that you're basically covering the whole territory?
Yesterday I pretty well covered the whole territory, so I think that probably because of the way the oil is acting right now, it's not affecting the birds.
Do you have any handles on whether there's been any impact of fish?
No.
The only other comment I might make is if you're looking at birds, sea otters, other seals, and whales, that as you look at them over the continuum, birds and sea otters are more vulnerable because of the impacts of the oil on the feathers of the birds and then on the fur of the sea otters. And when you start looking at the seals and cetaceans, because of they don't have hair and fur, they are generally less vulnerable to oil, and the impacts will be somewhat different.
Could you just clarify what your responsibility is here, what you're overseeing or what your capacity is?
The U.S. Department of Interior is a trustee for migratory waterfowl, sea otters, well as polar bears and walrus, which we're not worrying about in this particular incident. And we are co-trustees with those resources with the state of Alaska. So we are basically here monitoring what Exxon is planning to do to make sure that we feel comfortable with their plans.
And if you
and,
don't,
and to
say
provide
so.
Any advice or assistance that we can.
So you're sort of here at, to be of assistance to them if they need.
Right, and if we weren't comfortable with the International Bird Research Center folks, then that's something we would pass along to the Coast Guard. But we fully support the efforts that they've taken to date and feel very comfortable with that.
I think the press conference is coming to a close here. Folks are leaping up now and heading for the doors. Just to recap, the press conference opened this morning with the Lieutenant Villaskevich, I think I've learned how to pronounce it, the Coast Guard spokesman. Basically, he announced that about 3 miles of boom are currently in place, and that today another 3,000 feet of containment boom will be placed across Galena Bay, under the guidance and supervision of fishermen who've been asked to assist in identifying the best possible placement for those booms. The port remains closed. That much was also certain. Another announcement from the Coast Guard, another just a briefing point, was that at present, with the submersible pumps that have been provided on board the Exxon Valdez, 84,000 gallons per hour of the remaining million barrels of crude oil is being transferred by the pumps. These are not the pumps on board the ship, the ship's pumping systems, but rather submersible pumps that have been delivered to the vessel and lowered into the tanks. At that 84,000 gallon per hour rate, it would take 7 more days to empty the remaining million barrels of oil off the stricken Exxon Valdez. We also heard from Tom McGinnis of NOAA, who briefly was here to introduce himself. There will be a major NOAA press conference this afternoon, or a briefing in which they will try to have more detail. NOAA is here interested primarily in the impacts on the marine environment, on the animals, sea life and such, and we should begin to get some real information from NOAA at that time this afternoon. KCHU will plan on covering that event. If it's here at the Civic Center, we'll be able to broadcast it. If it's elsewhere, we'll try to provide you with the best reports we can. Finally, we heard from Pamela Bergman, who is with the U.S. Department of Interior and is here at an advisory role unless there is a need for her to step in and take action. She talked about the efforts undertaken to set up cleansing centers for the birds and discussed with some of the reporters the potential impact on the marine wildlife. And that pretty well wraps up this conference. We're expecting a press announcement. It may not be a press conference, but at least an announcement from the City of Valdez this morning. City of Valdez and the State Department of Environmental Conservation have been working diligently to establish what the city's role shall be in this. Expecting some news from that. And at this point, Exxon has scheduled another major press conference at 11 o'clock this morning here at the Civic Center. So at this point, we will plan on being on the air at 11 with that press conference back here at the Civic Center. Exxon giving us their briefing of the day. And then if we have any news out of City Hall after 10 o'clock, we'll have that on the air for you. One more point. There was some discussion this morning about a test of burning, igniting the oil. That test evidently was fairly successful. And throughout the day, we may get indications that more and more they will attempt to burn off some of the crude part of the crude slick. They isolate parts of it and then ignite it out in the center of the sound. Of course, this technique cannot be used close to shore, obviously. And that, I think, is about it for this moment. Again, we'll be back on the air as often as we can find information. There's been a meeting going on this morning among fishermen down at the Westmark. We have no report on that as yet. Claire Richardson is in the air right now on a inspection tour over the area. We'll have a report from her later upon her return. And Steve Heimel from APRN is here at KCHU assisting us, and he's back at the station and is preparing her report for noon today for the statewide network. And at this point, that's all from the Civic Center. I'm Dave Hammack. You've been listening to a live press briefing by the Coast Guard, NOAA, and the U.S. Department of Interior here at the Valdez Civic Center. Thank you much, and back to you, Mike.
The amount recovered, that will be available after 1800 this evening. Exxon will be gauging the recovery tanks at that time. The amount that is leaked, the Coast Guard has revised its estimates. from over 250,000 barrels to about 240,000 barrels. I believe these coincide with Exxon's. For those of you interested, the National Transportation Safety Board arrived at approximately 11 o'clock today. They changed clothes and were flown out to the Exxon Valdez about an hour later. They've indicated that they will be on the Exxon Valdez for 6 or 7 hours, 5 to 6 hours in that time frame. And they're not prepared to comment on their activities yet, otherwise I'd have them up here. I'm sorry, there are four people from the National Transportation Safety Board, and unfortunately I don't have their names. They didn't stop long enough. Has the leaking stopped? Yes, the leaking has stopped. The amount of fuel oil transferred from the Exxon Valdez to the Baton Rouge. As of noontime today, 37,583 barrels using pumps from the Coast Guard strike team has been transferred to the Exxon Baton Rouge. Coast Guard activities involve helicopters from Air Station Kodiak, ferrying materials from the Valdez Airport out to the tanker, also personnel. Is the spill contained? No. No, the southern edge, as I said, is on roughly on a line from Knoll's Head to Naked Island. The only land impact so far has been on Reef Island and Bly Island. I do not have the penalty for pilotage requirements, or if somebody violates pilotage requirements. That seemed to be popular this afternoon. Okay, a pilot is required from Rocky Point, or let's say from the Port of Valdez out to Rocky Point. From Rocky Point to approximately the Bly Reef area, a person with a pilot endorsement, doesn't have to be the master, but a person with a pilot endorsement on his license must be on the bridge of the vessel. Okay, from the Port of Valdez, from Port Valdez to Rocky Point, a pilot must be on the vessel. From Rocky Point to an area roughly level with Bly Island, or alongside Bly Island, a person with a pilot endorsement must be on the bridge of the vessel.
Is there any way in general to enforce that, or is it just an honor system?
I'm not sure, sir. I don't know. I know we don't have Coast Guard personnel riding the tankers in and out. It's a requirement. I also understand the state of Alaska has its own set of pilotage requirements. That's why we were not able to determine the penalties for not having a pilot on board.
Did Sir make that at the endorsement?
As far as I know, sir, no, he didn't. I believe Exxon said that later on, earlier this evening, or earlier this afternoon. The results of the first dispersion test, they worked, but they weren't as efficient as they'd like, as hoped. For the burning, tests did show lots of promise. They were going to be trying it on a larger scale later this afternoon, so I imagine we're talking about right about now. And finally, we did receive some questions.
Yeah.
No, sir, I don't. But if you'll get with me afterwards, I'll try and get that information to you, and if you could spread it around, because I'm sure there's a lot of interest. Okay, we've been asked several times to comment on the initial response of Alyeska and Exxon. Okay, we're not going to talk about it anymore. It's been addressed several times by Alyeska and Exxon. They've made their own admissions as to what they did right and what they did wrong, so it's starting to get redundant. However, on the present activities, I have the following quote from Commander Steve McCall. He's the captain of the port and the federal on-scene coordinator. And I quote, "They brought in a lot of equipment and more is coming in. Getting it from the arrival points in Valdez to the scene has been, is, and will continue to be one of the more difficult parts of the operation. Exxon's doing well under an extremely difficult response situation, the extent of which has never been seen in the history of pollution response in the United States." That's a direct quote from Commander McCall. I just left him. And finally, for those of you that may be interested, Commander McCall's staff is working on a way to reopen the Port of Valdez.
How long do you think that might take to come in and reload?
I'm not sure, sir. The executive officer is involved in it, and he just got back off the Exxon Valdez. It may be 1 or 2 days, it may be 3 days, but right in that time frame.
That pipeline isn't, if those ships aren't loaded over, say, a week, what's the concern?
I'm not sure, sir. I do know Exxon has mentioned that they have a 6-day storage capacity in there. So, yes, Mr. Campbell.
I think
The in-place burning test. From what I understand, sir, a certain amount of oil or an amount of oil is corralled. Then some type of incendiary, I believe it's a jellied gasoline mixture, something highly flammable is put inside to aid in the combustion. And from there it will burn. They try and corral it in. I believe they use a fireproof boom, and then they try and burn the oil that's on in the corralled by the boom.
You said the earlier one that they tried, they were satisfied with?
Yeah, they were very happy with the results. They're going to try it on a larger scale.
Does it actually burn the oil up then?
Yeah, we're talking. Yes, sir. It does burn and smoke and flames.
Thanks.
The dispersion that you said worked, but not as well as they hoped.
Not as effective as they had hoped. No, sir, I don't. Yes, ma'am.
When you talk about the, so you don't want to talk about that anymore, but the blood alcohol test, can you tell us when that was administered to the crew?
I can tell you it was administered Friday morning, ma'am, or the blood samples were taken Friday morning. I'm not sure of the exact time.
Would that be like after 8 a.m.?
No, because I didn't get here until I started getting my orders, and it had been done before I got here.
So do you have the results of those tests in?
No, sir, I don't. I don't know, sir.
Are you going to make them public once you get them back?
As I said before, the test results will become part of the investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board will have those results. It appears right now that they will be conducting a separate investigation besides the Coast Guard's. When the results of the investigation come out, that's when I anticipate the results will be released to the public.
In your investigation, are the three principals involved admitted taking alcohol or using drugs during the course of this, aside from the test?
No, sir, I'm not aware of anything to that. And I don't think that the tests admit that, sir. It's two separate issues.
Coast Guard's best estimate or best reason as to why this ship did go so far off course. Do you have at this time a theory that you're...
No, sir, we don't. The Coast Guard provides the aids to navigations, and we provide services in the area. We don't know why the vessel went aground.
Your radar system extend far enough out past that hazardous area?
I'm sorry, sir?
Why does your radar system, which tracks these vessels, why does it not extend out far enough past that hazardous area?
Well, sir, the area where the vessel went aground is at the edge, at the perimeter of the radar system, and I think, depending on the circumstances and the scales, it may extend even farther. It's important to note that the vessel wasn't being monitored, and it's in an area where vessels normally aren't monitored. There was no other traffic, and visibility was good. The master requested permission to go from the outbound lane to the inbound lane to avoid ice. And I believe the tanker in front of him may have requested the same permission. I'm not sure about that. But it's not an unusual request. No, there was nothing unusual. Yes, ma'am.
This pilot endorsement on the license, is that the same as the certification? Is it a sticker on his license? What is it?
Oh, whether he has a little stamp? I'm not sure exactly what it entails, but certain requirements have to be met for him to get an endorsement, something that says he is qualified to pilot vessels, act as a pilot for vessels in that area.
In that area. And that's
for example, a pilot certificate for Rocky Point wouldn't necessarily be valid for Louisiana.
Okay, and this is because the area is narrow, because there are
certain requirements when you navigate in every area. I believe the requirements also carry all the way down to, say, what we call a six-pack license. You know, they're only valid in certain areas because certain local knowledge is required.
I'm curious as to why your radar operator authorized a change in course and, having done so, didn't continue to track him.
I don't know, sir, but I do know that the request was not unusual, and it's an area that's not normally tracked if there's no other traffic in the area.
What was, in fact, there ice in the sound at that point?
Ice in the sound now, sir.
I understand.
Any other questions, please?
Yeah, exactly. Do you know, is there a penalty associated with, navigating or piloting a ship in that area without the proper endorsements?
I imagine there is, sir. I don't know. Before I came over here, we were attempting to, or I had asked some of the marine safety people what the penalty was, because I anticipated that question. Unfortunately, it's an area I believe that the state also has certain requirements, so there are two sets of penalties, and they may be mixed or whatever.
Do they all have a certification process, or are they...
I don't know.
Okay, I'm in charge of the operation. on steam or what?
Okay, Exxon has assumed responsibility for the spill. I know you've heard that before. That means they're in charge of coordinating resources to take care of cleaning up the spill, of coordinating the skimmers, of unloading fuel from the Exxon Valdez to the Exxon Baton Rouge. At this point in time, the on-scene coordinator, in coordination with the regional response team, provides assistance to Exxon. They do this in the form of what resources we have available. They provide technical expertise along the lines of, there's a scientific coordinator there for issues that relate to environmental impact. So right now, we're sitting back and we're monitoring Exxon's activities. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry, the on-scene coordinator is Commander Steve McCall. He is also captain of the port for Port Valdez. Oh, sure. And these notes, we'll smooth type them out and get you plenty of copies. Okay. He asked me to repeat it if you don't mind. Okay. Okay, again, this is a quote from Commander Steve McCall, captain of the port and the federal on-scene coordinator. They brought in lots of equipment and more is coming in. Getting from the arrival points in Valdez to the scene has been, is, and will continue to be one of the more difficult parts of the operation. Exxon's doing well under extremely, extremely difficult response situation, the extent of which has never been seen in the history of the pollution response in the United States. Now, sir.
Do you anticipate any difficulty because of this wind, and if there's a storm that is in fact brewing, what do you think this might do to the spill at this point?
Well, I know that the wind will help with the dispersant use, but I also realize I'm not sure what impact it will have on the stability of the vessel. Wind is something that every mariner takes into consideration. Excuse me. Yes, sir.
Up until about 1982, vessel traffic controllers were required to pot the vessels once the pilot departed Rocky Point, once every 6 minutes until clear of Bly Reef. When they would take that bearing and range from Potato Point, they were required at that time to plot the position of the vessel on a chart, a copied chart. In about 1982, the Coast Guard stopped requiring their vessel traffic controllers to physically plot that on a chart, where they would just ink plot it on the map. And they would record those bearing and ranges every 6 minutes, and those would go into a permanent file. Why isn't the Coast Guard now physically plotting those ships as they go out through the Narrows and keeping a consistent record of it? The reason for doing that was so the controller would watch the ship.
I don't know, sir. That decision was made in 1982. I can't really comment on it now. Go ahead.
These vessels request to avoid icebergs at this time of year?
No, sir, I don't.
What percentage of them are?
Why haven't
you found that out? That seems like a real simple thing to find out.
Sir, I've been involved with the spill for the last few days. Nobody except, in fact, that's the first time that question's come up. I'll be glad to work with you after this briefing to see what we can do. Barrels.
Barrels. Is oil being pumped off now?
Yes, sir, it is. That estimate was as of noon. I haven't been able to get
that. There's been continual.
Yes, sir. And I believe earlier today I mentioned that they were pumping 10,000 gallons of barrels. I can't remember the number. No.
And this is with those portable pumps as opposed to the ship's pumping system.
Yes, ma'am.
Is it the Coast Guard's responsibility to make sure that these oil cleanup contingency plans are up to snuff, or is that just something you rely on?
I don't know, sir. I believe you asked that question earlier, and I'll try and get that answer back.
No, it's a different question.
Okay, somebody else had asked that question earlier, and I haven't been able to find that answer. I haven't had time. Yes, sir.
Mr. Iorossi said the slick is 12 square miles. You're saying 100?
Yes, sir.
How do you account for that discrepancy?
I don't know, sir. The captain of the port, Commander McCall, has estimated it to be approximately a square, about 10 miles by 10 miles. I can't account for the discrepancy. I do know that Commander McCall is meeting with Mr. Iorossi now to talk over different aspects of the operation. I have time for one more if anybody's interested.
How much further would the vessel have needed to travel for the license endorsement not to have been necessary?
how far short of the endorsement boundary was the vessel when it went on the reef?
Okay, I'm not sure of the exact boundary. I know it's in the area of Bly Reef. So. Okay,
the helmsman, sir, the helmsman, the third mate, and the captain have all been tested, blood tests?
Yes, sir.
And do you know the name of the helmsman? It wasn't given out today.
No, I don't have it.
And is it drug as well as alcohol?
It's a blood test. I'm not sure if it's an all-encompassing test or what.
So what's the test held? Is it now up to whatever wind speed was being forecast?
I don't know.
This is Dave Hammack. For those stations that may have just joined us, the Coast Guard has been giving a briefing. Coast Guard Lieutenant Vilaskevich has been speaking, and now Tom McGinnis from the National Oceanic from NOAA is now prepared to the podium.
Yeah.
We are live at the Valley Civic Center.
I'm the Assistant Administrator for Ocean Services and Coastal Zone Management at NOAA, also Director of the National Ocean Service. We have a prepared statement that's sitting out by the door here, and I will summarize it quickly, and then I'll tell you why I came up. First thing I'd like you to mention is that under the National Contingency Plan, NOAA provides technical personnel to the Coast Guard and coordinates the science among the federal and state agencies. We have 20 people on site right now. They are gathered from all over the United States, as are you, and they represent our Western Regional Hazardous Spill Laboratory in Seattle, the National Marine Mammal Lab, the Office of Aircraft Operations in Miami, the Auk Bay Lab of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and of course the Weather Service office here in Valdez. Some of the personnel that are here today have been involved in every major oil spill in the United States for the last 13 years. So they bring a tremendous historical knowledge of how these things develop. Our concerns are as serious as they are urgent. This is a unique situation in that it is a very remote area presenting very difficult problems, and we see a potential for acute and severe impacts to the animals that use the surface of the waters, i.e. marine mammals, seabirds, and intertidal fisheries. We're also concerned about the long-term impacts of salmon fry, herring, spawn, and tanner crab. Every afternoon and evening, our experts are making oil distribution maps and projections of the oil spill trajectory, also doing weather forecasts, detailed marine mammal surveys, and during the day sampling the intertidal shellfish and sediments and investigating the extent of the oil, both the two-dimensional extent of the oil on the surface and the amount of oil in the water column under the slick in the waters of Prince William Sound. One of the problems we've had over the last couple of days has been that given the color of the water and the lighting, it's been very, very difficult to see the extent of the oil from the air and to evaluate it, its thickness and extent. We've been making daily flights in the NOAA helicopter to assess the situation and gather data, and then using our models over at the Westmark Hotel, we've been doing these trajectories and forecasts. Since I arrived yesterday, I've met with the Coast Guard and with the representatives of Exxon, and today I visited the site with the Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District, and then all afternoon I spent with the NOAA team flying over the slick. I wanted to be available to you today because it's been our sense that you could use a little more hard information about the impact and the extent of the slick itself. So I brought along with me a number of folks who are expert in oil spill dynamics, historical extent of oil spill impacts, the effects in the water column, the coastal zone, fisheries, marine mammals, the birds. I don't know if the National Weather Service guy is here to give you a forecast, but I have tried to get him over here. And also, if you are interested in the interaction among the federal and state and Alaskan state officials, there's someone here to talk about that. I just felt that if you have any of those questions, I've tried to make the people who could give you specific and detailed answers about that available. The other thing is, I apologize, I had hoped to come in with an oil spill evaluation to show you the extent specifically of the spill in Prince William Sound. Unfortunately, we didn't land until nearly 3:15, so it's not ready, but it will be available over at the Westmark within the hour in the chart room, which is the name of the room that we're using for our headquarters. And following following the creation of that map, which details the extent of the oil spill, we then will start working with the models to come up with forecasts of where it will be tomorrow and tomorrow night and the next day. Unfortunately, since the map itself won't be available till 6, and then we have to work from that, the forecasts won't be available till quite late this evening, between 10 and midnight, but they will be there for you if you want them. So does anybody have any questions about some of the impacts of the oil? Go ahead, sorry?
Would you classify this as a catastrophe yet?
Yet? No. Well, I guess that's all in how you define it, isn't it, really? It's been quite a well-behaved spill up until now. One of the things we noticed as we flew over was that it has yet to, it's really only affected the shore in one area that we could see, that is the backside of Reef Island. But of course it's not dispersing, and the wind is picking up outside, so the potential is there.
As far as the impact on the water column, if dispersants are used, we've been given all sorts of different figures for how much of the spill they might be able to affect. But basically, as I understand it, what the dispersants do is break down the oil into smaller particles, and then that still descends into the water table. So is that, in fact, the case? And if that is the case, what is the implication of that for the eventual impact of using dispersants to treat the spill on bottom fish, shellfish, and other marine life?
Jack, are you listening to this? Jack and Michelle, you want to come up here? We've just had quite a long conversation about that. Jackie is an expert in that area, so I think the best thing to do is make her available.
Okay, my name is Jackie Michelle with NOAA, and I guess Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L. The issues with use of dispersants are really a trade-off between what we consider to be intertidal impacts and subtidal impacts. So when you disperse the oil from the water surface, all you're trying to do is increase the rate of dilution. Oil on the water surface does not dilute very rapidly. It takes a long time, weeks, up to weeks perhaps. So by mixing it in the water column, you're diluting it into a much larger area, and that will hopefully reduce the exposures.
As far as the hydrographics within Prince William Sound, there's been some discussion of water over a 10-day period flushing out through, I think it's Montague Strait or something like that. What does that mean as far as, like, you know, whether or not the oil as it disperses would accumulate in significant amounts affecting, say, the pink salmon or the herring spawn or whatever? I mean, do you have any idea on that yet?
Jerry, you want to answer that? We have an oceanographer who can do that much better than I can.
By the way, one thing I would mention is I have these people available to you for the rest of the time you're here. They're in the chart room.
This is KCH Radio in Valdez. We are broadcasting at this moment a live press conference from the Valdez Civic Center ballroom. NOAA Coordinator Tom McGinnis has brought in a variety of specialists who are working with the various agencies that are responding.
Your comment that the circulation in Prince William Sound basically comes in through Hanshin Brook and leaves through Montague, it is a circulation that comes and goes, so there's a natural sort of flushing process. If the oil were simply to stay exactly with the water, then it would exit, and that would be the end of it, and there probably wouldn't be large accumulations in virtually any measurable sense. Unfortunately, the oil really, in the form it's in, it's floating on the surface, and it's affected by other things. In particular, there's a lot of mixing from fresh water coming off of the glacier, in particular Glacier Bay, that area. If people have been out flying around, you can see that a different coloration to that water and the mixing front that's going on. In addition to that, the wind pushes the oil that's floating around on top of the water, and so although the water may turn and go out in 10 days, if it gets pushed into a little bay, that doesn't flush in 10 days. Okay. So to the extent that you have shoreline impacts, you wouldn't expect those to flush quickly. And so it's a little bit more complicated than the water just going in and out, which it certainly does.
So, which maybe get back to you on that point then, what does that tell us? The fishermen have made time and again clear that what they're most concerned about is the potential impact on the herring roe fishery that's coming up and on the pink salmon. And the people that are with the hatcheries here have been talking about their concern over being able to release the fry so that they'll have zooplankton or phytoplankton, whatever it is that they eat. Do we know at this point anything about what the potential impact is going to be?
We actually know quite a bit about the toxicity of this oil. And the reason that you want to disperse it is because you're trying to dilute it down to the levels that are not toxic. From a lot of studies done in this oil, the most toxic life forms are going to be the larval stages, the most young life history stages. We don't expect much toxicity on the adult fish. It's the larvae we're concerned about. So you want to dilute it down to levels below which it's toxic. And the data for this oil show that it has toxicity on the order of 1 to 2 parts per million. So we can get the oil diluted down to below those levels, we shouldn't expect any toxic effects. And that's the idea, is to get them diluted down. When you have a thin layer of oil, you're mixing that into a very large water column. Studies have shown that even if you disperse this oil, it would naturally mix in the water down to below 1 part per million in about 30 feet. So it's an upper water column toxic shock, but once that gets further diluted, it should be down below the levels that we consider to be toxic to these shellfish and finfish.
In the food chain, as microscopic organisms ingest it, and as salmon,
oil is biodegradable. It will actually degrade, and so this is a lot different than any of the other kind of more persistent hydrocarbons. It will degrade down to very low levels and actually be removed over time. So we don't expect a food chain potential. That only occurs when we have persistent chemicals.
Specific pollutants that they're using, are these dispersants? I'd heard that maybe it's more concentrated because of the water temperature here.
Well, they might be using higher dosage rates to try to increase the efficiency of the dispersant, but the dispersant they're using is either as toxic or less toxic than the oil, so it's not adding any toxicity.
You know what the constituents are of the dispersant that they're using?
It's proprietary, and so that's not known. But there's a group in California that's been doing some very detailed toxicity studies this year with this specific dispersant. And they've been using them on these most sensitive life stages, so they have the best data, and their data show that it's about the 1 part per million level toxicity.
You mentioned the biodegradability of oil. There have also been studies done in Port Valdez on low level accumulation of BETX. From port operations there, which seem to imply that those substances will accumulate and then increase as you go up the food chain. What about those as a component of the oil that's being dispersed?
You're talking about a chronic discharge there. It's a little bit different. You have higher suspended sediments in Valdez Arm. And see, that's a pathway for the oil to be absorbed on the sediments in the water column under the bottom sediments. And therefore, it's not degraded as rapidly. When you have it mixing in the water column, you have a lot of oxygen, a lot of bacteria that actually enhance the degradation.
In the arm as opposed to in the port?
Into the open waters of Prince William Sound. You know, there's very low suspended sediments out there, so we don't expect to have a pathway by which the oil will get from the water column to the bottom sediments.
So you don't expect it to accumulate in the bottom sediments?
No, not a bit. Except, well, there will be certain conditions. If we get shoreline stranding, the oil can be absorbed on the sediments in the intertidal zone, and there you can have erosion from shoreline oil. And that's why it's very important, and I think Exxon is moving toward, whenever there's any oil on the shoreline, they'll try to remove that through a manual cleanup to to prevent this leaching, particularly in areas where we have the herring spawning in the nearshore areas.
Is skimming preferable to dispersants if that is available?
You sure is. You'd like to remove it. Even if you dilute it into the water column, you're not removing it from the environment.
So the fact that that the sea has been calm since Friday, Saturday, and for most of Sunday, when skimming would essentially be a relatively easy operation, wouldn't that have been preferable if that was available and capable if the equipment was here?
You know, the first line of defense in any kind of oil spill is always removal, containment, and recovery. That's in every contingency plan. That's the highest priority and the highest preference. Dispersant is only a tool in the response kit that people use.
Are you speaking specifically for the containment plan in this area, or are you speaking in general?
Every contingency plan I've ever seen relies upon containment and recovery first.
The contingency plan for this area of a spill of 200,000 barrels or more seems to indicate that dispersing is the main thought. Would that be my misinterpretation of
it? I think so. I mean, in every case, they want to recover the product. Dispersing is just an alternative to try to reduce these intertidal impacts. You know, the oil, when it floats on the surface, especially in Prince William Sound, is not going to go anywhere for a long time, as we've seen. So in order to reduce impacts to marine mammals and birds, dispersant may be a very important alternative under certain conditions.
You've read and seen then Alyeska's specific response plan for this area?
I've seen pieces of it. I haven't read the whole thing entirety.
Have the results of these dispersant tests been satisfactory enough that you think they'd be effective if they were used, or they're worth using?
That's a ongoing controversy in, you know, just how effective are dispersants. And I think, the use of dispersants becomes less effective over time because of changing in the chemical properties of the oil. They become less dispersible. And no one seems to know when that window of opportunity closes permanently. You know, it's a continuum. And a lot of site-specific conditions such as weather, you know, sunshine, the rate of weathering, you know, certain oils weather very differently. Prudhoe Bay, you know, in the first 24 hours, about 15% of the oil evaporated.
They said they just tested it. So I'm saying, were those test results good enough that you think it ought to be used?
From what I understand, they were inconclusive, and they're mixed reports, and that's usually the case.
Going back a second, you said something about in the first 24 hours, 50% of the oil evaporated.
Did 15.
15%.
15%. You know, crude oil is a very complex mixture of very light hydrocarbons that evaporate very readily, especially when you spread them over a thin layer on the water surface.
What are the components of the VOCs will evaporate, right? What were the components of that?
In fact, it's very good. The most volatile components are the ones that are most toxic, so evaporation is one way to reduce the toxicity over time. So the oil that's moving around now is probably much less toxic than it was during the initial spill. So the benzenes, xylenes, the toluenes, some of the lightweight hydrocarbons are the ones that are dissolving. These are what we call the aromatic hydrocarbons. They're the more toxic, but they're also the more volatile, so they'll be removed very quickly.
So they're in the air and wandering around the environment, but they're dispersing, which is what...
Right. They're not in the water column, which is of more concern.
The environmental impacts of burning, is there any comparable? How do you guys weigh that versus use of dispersants in terms of its effect on the water table?
You mean the trade-offs between intertidal and subtidal?
No, between the burning and the actual dispersants.
I don't know. The burning, I don't have much experience with that, but the test showed that it was pretty effective to, you know, in yesterday's test. But I think when you burn it, you were really removing it from water surface, so that's reducing the long-term impacts to anything else if this more weathered product is moving along. So burning would be better than trying to recover it.
The issue with burning oil is twofold. One of them is just large-scale air pollution. And this is an area which has very little large-scale air pollution. You don't have big urban areas here to contribute to that very much. A shorter-range issue is a smoke as a nuisance problem. And again, we're talking about a pretty large area. And the burn would probably not be a significant threat in that sense. You know, this isn't the L.A. Basin or anything where you're going to have a smog problem associated with it.
Mr. Williams. Your estimate?
As far as I know, there have been no reports of dead animals yet, though the surveys have focused on oil distribution and protection strategies. From the regional response team meeting today, they observed 75 oiled birds, two oiled sea lions, specifically, and there will be more observations as the survey teams come in the rest of the day. Yes?
I had a question.
Okay, I'm Steve Zimmerman. I work with the Alaska Regional Office of the National Marine Fisheries Service in Juneau. We have not had our daily wrap-up meeting, which we have at 8 o'clock in the evening, so I don't know what the other agencies that have been out have found. We flew virtually the entire west side of that entrance area from Valdez down to Hitchinbrook entrance. We checked out all of the harbor seal and stellar sea lion rookeries and haul-out sites that we are aware of, and historically they're pretty predictable areas. We did not see any dead animals. We didn't see any animals that were even oiled or impacted at this point. We did not, however, go looking for that. What we were trying to do is to find out what the distribution of animals was and to try and find a couple good study sites so that as the oil moves in on those sites, we can determine the response of the animals to the movement of oil into the area which they've been occupying. So to summarize the question, we, in our group today working the west side, did not see any dead marine mammals. We did find one dead common mer, but it had no oil on it, so it may have been a natural mortality.
Another member of this team is Everett Robinson Wilson of the Department of Interior, who's the bird expert.
Yeah, yesterday we went out and looked for birds both in distress and birds that were dead, and we did find some common mers in the oil that were dead. I think the total when we got through was four. After reviewing my notes again, there are about 95 birds that we determined were oiled and in distress, found mostly in the Bligh Island, Reef Island area, and the West Bay area. I haven't been out today. I've been doing other things. We have some people that did do some flying today and were especially interested in sea otters and the birds, and we should have some information later tonight.
Predict it's going to go as far as impacts on wildlife.
Where we predicted is that it should wash over the west side, or excuse me, the east side of Naked Island and that island complex. And the last projection I looked at, which is now getting a little bit old, then showed it to edge north, move over the top of the islands, and come up again on the back side, virtually surrounding the islands on the north and east side with oil. That's all we know at the moment, because it has not reached the islands yet. Go ahead.
On wildlife.
Well, as far as the impact on birds, when we get closer to the islands and things, we would expect that the impacts would be much greater on the birds, because the birds are not out in the center of the sound. They're going to be associated with land masses, although they do stay in the water most of the time. So we'd expect more birds to be oiled and to have more deaths probably due to that. Same way with the otters. There were some otters the other day that were in oil. They didn't show any signs of distress. And similarly, when we get oil over there in the Naked Islands in that area, we would expect that more otters would be oiled and in distress.
I actually had a question for you, Tom. You had said that the spill was pretty well behaved until now.
Until as far as we have seen it.
Okay.
We just landed at 3:30.
Okay.
One of the things we noticed on the way over here is that the wind does seem to be kicking up. The spill was, Jerry, are you out there? About how far off Naked Island would you say it was?
The leading edge was about 2 miles.
About 2 miles off the island, to the east of the island, and also it was not too far south of Glacier Island. So with 2 miles more to travel, we've been very lucky. The weather's been calm, and it's taken quite a while to get there. So. We'll just have to see tomorrow.
I ran into some people this morning at the job service office who were, they thought, being hired to go out and start some beach cleanup and such. I guess that wasn't necessary then yet today?
Well, there is oil on reef island.
And
it has worked
there?
Its way around the back of that island. We saw that as we were flying over. But I didn't, Jerry, I didn't see a lot on the beach. Did you? Yet?
No.
It was mostly in the water, in the channel there between the two islands.
So you didn't see anybody out there doing then any cleanup on the beaches? That wasn't necessary.
We saw a lot of boats stringing booms around Bly Island, on the west side of Bly Island, and of course there are a couple of booms at the entrance to Galena Bay, north of the spill. But as far as cleaning up, as I said, fortunately so far there hasn't been much in the way of beach cleanup to do.
Excuse me. I was on the north shore of Bly earlier today in this little cove there, and it's kind of a rocky sand beach. Mm-hmm. And I stick my hand down in the sand and bring it out, get all this little tar stuff on my skin and everything. And there's this ridge of rocks that kind of runs, you know, from the cove, and a line of black snotty stuff. Mm-hmm. About halfway, about 6 feet up from the water line. Am I looking at residue that's washed up there and left like a bathtub ring?
Yesterday, Jerry and the crew, come on back up here for a minute. Jerry and the crew went around and landed around there because it looked the same to them. And unfortunately, and we saw it again today, the quality of the water qualities of the water and the beach around those islands is making it very difficult to distinguish what is and what isn't from the air. So he landed. I'm going to let him talk about it.
We have a number of problems here in terms of trying to map the oil, which are in some sense related to the particular areas of the sound here. The first one that makes it difficult is that the water itself is quite dark. If any of you have been out flying around or driving around, you notice that the water in the sound here is almost the color of ink, particularly if you've got a cloud cover. Second issue is that one of the rules, if you're going to look at sea surface, you don't want to look into the sun. On the other hand, almost any view you take around the area here, at low angles, you're seeing snow fields behind it. So it's bright in any direction you look. So observability is very difficult. In addition to that, there is a great deal of natural organic material here. That's a very productive region. And anytime, whether there's oil spills or not, you can go out and look, and there's sheen and slick areas, places where the roughness of the sea surface has changed slightly by natural conditions. In addition to that, there's a good deal of algae growth and this sort of thing that accumulates in froth lines and what looks to be brown, frothy, almost like milk chocolate. Okay. Unfortunately, when oil starts to weather, it forms what people call chocolate mousse, which is very much the same color. And so there's a real problem about trying to determine what happens to the oil and what happens to other things that look like oil. And in this particular case, early on in the stage, this oil hasn't started to emulsify very much, so we don't have that ambiguity at the moment. We will have later. There were reports yesterday of many places where there was this brown sort of frothy stuff. We looked at that, and again, one of the kind of advantages that we have is we've been to hundreds of oil spills, and we've been doing this for a very long time. And so we looked at this stuff, and most of it we could dismiss out of hand as not oil, but looked like oil. But in some cases, it was really very confusing, and as he pointed out in one case, after circling it three or four times with a helicopter and opening the door and hanging out at 25 feet and dropping rhodamine dye into it so we could get a color check and watching whether the prop wash from the helicopter was going to disturb it and give us rainbow patterns around the edge. I mean, we went into some detail here. And at that point, we still didn't really have an answer, and we had to land. And I went over and did this, you know, put it in my hands, and tried to see. And if it's oil, you can smell it. If it's oil, it feels slippery. And it wasn't. It was plankton or algae.
There was a long-term effect based on what you know about these
types of spills?
Well, we haven't seen this thing unfold yet, so we really can't answer that question.
Speculate.
Again, I don't really know. I think there's a lot of work going on here to try and see what's going to happen. I think at this stage in a spill, it's very common for people to be appalled by what they see, and rightfully so. I mean, we are too. We're maybe a little bit more jaded than other people, but it's still an appalling thing to see that much oil out there and to smell it and look at it and all those other things. I think as this unfolds, we'll have a better idea about what kind of things are really damaged and what kind of intermediate or long-term effects we may have. In many cases, I have to say in the past, we've been pleased that it wasn't, quote, as bad as we thought it was going to be. And I think another thing is, at this stage in the, I'm going to take a slam at the press here, at this stage in the reporting, everybody is saying what they see, which again, as I said before, is appalling. But after things calm down, after things get a little bit better, it's not near as good a news. And that's kind of the last thing you hear about it. So in a way, there may be some over-reporting going on now. What I would encourage is for all you folks to hang around here and see what happens. It's not a non-problem, and it's not over. But we're going to look at it, and we being a very large collection of people now. The state's very interested here. The fishermen groups are very active. And I think Exxon is not a fly-by-night company either. They're paying a lot of attention to this, and they're bringing in a lot of talent. And probably what we're seeing now is an organization coming together that's going to work on this thing. And we'll find out.
So what are the problem areas that you're most concerned about, that you're most closely watching?
Somebody else in the audience? Dave Kinn. We have another person here.
I would add, when I go back to Washington tomorrow or the next day or the next day, if you still find it useful to have us come up in the afternoon and talk to you about how the story is unfolding in terms of the effect and the impact, then I will make these people available to you, and I've asked Dave to come up and give a statement, a short statement that explains what he's seen that day, to provide you that map of where it is that day, and then to have these people available. At the moment, it seems like it's a pretty useful thing. So let me introduce Dave Kennedy, then you'll know who to collar if he doesn't show up.
And the question was again?
Sorry, Dave.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question.
But what are you most concerned about at this point? Or what are you most closely watching?
Certainly, when you've got this much oil in the water, you want to look immediately at those resources out there that can be affected. And really, in the press release that Tom already gave you, I think he covered those areas that we're most concerned about. It's a broad range. It starts with the herring spawn, the shellfish spawns, certainly the seabirds, all of the variety of marine mammals that are included here, from whales to sea otters to stellar sea lions. I think I'm probably beginning to touch the surface. There are some secondary problems that may arise that you have to begin to look at now to try and attempt to measure and gauge what may happen later, secondary effects that are not immediately obvious to a number of different parts of the environment. But I think I've really covered the majority of the issues that we have. Of course, all of us know that the key to the ultimate outcome of this thing is how successful the cleanup, containment, and salvage operation is going to be. So we are very, very concerned and watching very closely what happens out there in that arena. And of course, we know that one of the keys to that is the weather and the window, the beautiful window that we've had to try and effect some cleanup and offloading, lightering of that vessel. But obviously, that's one of our major concerns. We'd really like not to see the rest of that cargo go into the water.
Thanks very much. Just so I know myself, What is the timing for, say, tomorrow's news? We're going to...
Tom McGinnis of the FNOAA who's been the sort of coordinator of the federal response, people who've spoken at this conference today, is now working out logistics, deadline times with members of the press. What we've heard so far this afternoon, we started with a Coast Guard spokesman who basically gave a situation report, a briefing, an update of what the current status was, the various efforts, the booming across Galena Bay, the work with the test to ignite portions of the oil, and refused to answer some questions. The National Transportation Safety Board, the NSTB, has arrived in town. Their study team, who are conducting the investigation. That investigation will begin tomorrow. Officially, they have been out on the tanker all afternoon. To recap, the captain of the skipper has been relieved. He is on shore. The captain of the Exxon Valdez was the only man on board the vessel certified to pilot in the section of Prince William Sound where the accident occurred. At the time of the accident, he was not on the bridge. The third officer, Greg Cousins, was in control of the vessel. This conference is winding down to a close. We've had an impressive string of federal agency representatives, each of whom is looking at some portion of the impact. Today has been a day for getting people out over the water. Today has been a day of spectacular weather. However, the wind is picking up through the last, we are almost 3 days. At midnight tonight, we'll be 3 days into this incident. For the first 60 hours, the weather could not have been better for a response for work such as skimming or containment. Winds have been below 15 miles per hour, and seas have been 3 feet and less, which for Valdez Arm and Prince William Sound is definitely pond-like. However, the forecast did specify or did predict increasing winds, and in Port Valdez, visible from the Valdez Civic Center, you can begin to see the first appearance of white caps we've had in days. The winds are picking up, gusting to 20 and 30 miles per hour here in the port, and there have been small craft advisories posted for Valdez Arm. Valdez Arm is the entrance to the port area, and at the section where Valdez Arm enters Prince William Sound, that's where the location of Bly Island and the location of the stricken Exxon Valdez. There have been scheduled a press conference at 6 o'clock, about 35 minutes from now, by Exxon this morning at 11 o'clock. Exxon revealed diagrams of the damage that had occurred to the tanker, and revealed the fact there had been not one but two strikes. The vessel had scraped along its starboard side along a rock pinnacle and then come to rest squarely, almost in the exact middle of the vessel, on a reef, damaging all the centerline tanks, the largest holes on the vessel, and all of the starboard tanks, again, are damaged because of the scrape alongside the first pinnacle. Also revealed at that time were the fact that the master of the vessel was not on the bridge, at least at the time of the first contact. The Exxon press conference is scheduled for 6 p.m. Alaska time. We are planning on broadcasting that. We, of course, won't know for sure if it will start exactly on time. Last night, the Exxon 6 p.m. Press conference started at about 7:45. So we're hoping that it will be timely tonight. We will be standing by at the Civic Center to bring you the Exxon press conference, whatever time it does occur. For the moment, this is Dave Hammack reporting from the Valdez Civic Center. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.